Hi, my name is Raj Mehta, and I'm here with Richard Lehman on Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I'm fine, thank you, Raj. I'm here to continue talking in a rather rambling fashion about my experiences of EBM as a GP in the UK, having started practice in 1979. And seen the growth of EBM and the way it's affected the way general practitioners use evidence in their practice. Now, this is a slightly different angle from most accounts of EBM, which start from the point of view of a disease and the test for that disease and guidelines for that disease and so on. We come at things from a completely different angle. Patients present to us with undifferentiated symptoms, sometimes without a definable medical problem, and perhaps they will end up without a definite diagnostic label. So bear with me during this chat as we move from topic to topic, without necessarily following the textbook line on any particular aspect of EBM.
I think that's that reflects the reality of how we practice medicine, which is borrowed from textbooks, but dealing with the real world in front of us. So today's talk, I think, is going to be a very fun one, and it's titled Resuscitating EBM. And the reason Richard and I came up with that title is we thought that in the last several years, maybe in the last decade, the EBM movement has seemed to stall under its own weight, if you will. And with the COVID pandemic and with some of the new discoveries we made and how we responded to that, we felt like it was actually quite a dramatic success for EBM. It was almost as if EBM resuscitated in its response to this new pandemic. Before we jump into that, we kind of have to begin with how the EBM movement arose in the 1990s, its success and its failures and its struggles from 2000 to 2020 to kind of set the stage for what was so remarkable about that shift in 2020. And so we're going to begin in the 1990s with the start of EBM and the rise. And Richard, you can perhaps tell us, since you were a well-established and practicing GP at that time, what was it like when EBM first came on the scene?
Yes, it was a challenge. And the first challenge was whether to accept the term at all, because it was provocative. It almost implied that we hadn't practiced according to any kind of evidence before, whereas obviously we thought we knew a great deal about what we were doing. And we were constantly getting these reports that only 20% of what we were doing was actually based on clear evidence from randomized controlled trials. Well, that didn't seem true to me. And in fact, that figure's been revised upwards and upwards since then. The other thing was that the things that enthused the EBMers right from the start were not necessarily the things that enthused GPs the most. For instance, the use of diagnostic tests, which was highly relevant to certain aspects of screening and certain aspects of hospital medicine, didn't apply quite so much in general practice, which was still very much based on history and examination and the discriminating use of a limited number of diagnostic tests. Again, with the approach that only drugs used in randomized controlled trials could ever really be said to work didn't strike us as very realistic either, because we used most of the drugs that we used and still do use, and for instance the WHO list of essential drugs I learned today contains hardly any that were not present in the 1950s. So these were drugs that were known to work, sometimes so obviously that they didn't really need trials. Others that were more recent had been put through randomized controlled trials, but in populations that didn't really match the ones that we saw every day in general practice. And as far as the interactions between different drugs were concerned, that seemed to us to be a field that still needed an awful lot of development. Similarly, adverse reactions and personal reactions to drugs were things that EBM couldn't address at that point. That was the downside. On the other side, it was immensely exciting to think that these computers, which were sort of heavy monitored jobs that dominated our desks at that time, were not going to only ask us to do feed in data to them, but could actually provide us with data real time for use in practice, and that we were no longer reduced to having to scrabble for textbooks in order to find out ballpark figures for what we were saying to patients. So I ended up as a sort of medium late adopter, and then I became an enthusiast. It took about 2 years, I suppose. And then I threw myself into guidelines and systematic reviews and diagnostic testing and all that kind of thing, with results that are still quite mixed 20, 30 years later.
It's interesting you mentioned technology, because it seems to me, with the benefit of hindsight, that one of the drivers of UBM was the technological revolution, where you have the internet, you have computers, you have access to all this information at your fingertips, really at the point of care. Whereas previously it was, you know, you'd have to go look something up in a book or something, which is not easy to do in between seeing patients. And now with this new technology, it meshes very well with kind of a revisiting of this philosophy of how to best access this information, how to best present it, how to best apply it to the patients before us, and hopefully standardize some of the care and push out some of the things that we knew didn't work, but perhaps had still been lingering practices.
Absolutely. No, it was a very exciting period. Of course, there were always people who were technology obsessed, and that's always going to be the case. And then there are people like myself who take forever to learn how to use it. But it did strike me right from the start that this was a fantastic knowledge engine that was being put in our consulting rooms. And things that needed to be looked up in libraries could now be got online with increasing ease. You have to remember that it wasn't till about 1995 that email came in as a normal form of communication. I can remember that very year talking to colleagues, and you know, we were more or less judged by whether we had email or not, and I didn't, so I ended up getting email. But you know, these things that we take absolutely for granted were very slow to come in. And of course, email still isn't used in medical communication nearly enough for rather spurious concerns about confidentiality. So yes, technology was a huge driver. All of a sudden, things that could not be joined up together could be joined up together, and everyone was busy experimenting with how to join them up together, how to create good codes for medical conditions, what shortcuts you could take and what you couldn't. And of course, a lot of these systems didn't agree with each other and still don't.
It seems to me as well that a large part of medicine as practice, as a consensus, is helping to drive all of us providers to kind of meet certain basic standards. And I'm not sure how it was before the 1990s, but I imagine there was a lot of appeal to expertise and consultants. And with EBM, you now had a model or a way to discuss treatments or transitioning or approaches to care that allowed us to sidestep expertise, or at least argue against it if we had disagreements, and kind of build a consensus, not based on opinion, but hopefully based on the data that was present. At least it seems that was an ideal. Whether we actually achieve that or not is a different question.
Yeah, I mean, that really gets to the heart of the matter. In fact, Dave Sackett, who was the leader of the movement in many ways, wanted people to move on from the whole idea of expertise and wanted experts to move on from their notions of expertise, because he said that was the biggest barrier to evidence-based medicine, the idea that you knew how to do it properly without actually knowing the evidence. And there was this joy and slightly anarchical approach to medicine, which broke up the old hierarchies, we thought, and put us humble primary care practitioners on an equal footing.
Sounds like a revolution or a rebellion in medicine.
It was a revolution, but it was an incomplete revolution, and it was relatively bloodless. The consequence of that was a certain chaos in the intellectual framework of medicine, which, because hierarchies are very easy, you know, when you've got a pope who decides everything, then it becomes the business of the bishops and the priests to just disseminate doctrine, and the parishioners just have to obey the church. Now, that's not a model that you can adopt in medicine, and it was very good that that model, in as much as it ever existed, was swept away. And what we have now is the legacy of that. In fact, I've compared the revolution, which you mentioned, through the Reformation, which I just mentioned, where the individual believer has the right to interpret the evidence as she or he wishes. But there are, of course, rules to that. And the 90s were a time when those rules were being debated in an atmosphere of enthusiasm and almost joy. And some of that joy disappeared, but some of it still remains. And Gordon Guyatt is still quite a joyful proponent, and he invented the term evidence-based medicine, and he's still one of its most active practitioners on the front line, on quality of evidence and on the dissemination of evidence in real clinical care. So not all of it has died away.
This is perhaps, go ahead.
Became slightly more disenchanted with the term, but not with the principles. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'll shut up at that
point. No, that's good. We'll talk about that in a moment. I think I was going to say that this is perhaps a good transition, because it seems like one of the ideals of EBM was kind of shifting from, you know, this hierarchy of expertise to empowering autonomy among individual providers, that, hey, you can read the evidence and determine this for yourselves. And it was a very rule-based replacement, because EBM is very much heuristics. It's very much rules about how to interpret evidence. There's more advanced analytical approaches one can take, which requires more training, of course, but it's creating a series of rules that holds up reasonably well on how to do this to empower individuals. But of course, we get to the 2000s, and after the initial joy and enthusiasm of what EBM could promise us, there were some successes, some disappointments. One you highlighted to Sackett's, and I think he grew fond of the idea, but he had different terms for it. So I'm going to list off some of the successes that we saw in the 2000 post era, and then some of the disappointments, and then I'll turn it back over to Richard. So when I review EBM after 2000, some of the successes. One, we certainly got much better at having consistent ways of approaching test sensitivity, specificity, diagnostics. Yes, mainly used in the hospital setting, but also for screening and other purposes. Very, very helpful. We kind of made RCTs the gold standard. That was part of our heuristics decision making, so that we would generate evidence for the better and promote more RCT generation of data. When there were too many RCTs and there's too much data to keep track of, we started having guidelines to summarize all the information, provide us recommendations. And we had improvement in how we approach trials. We have clinicaltrials.gov, which forced us to use pre-registration, prevent outcome switching, p-hacking. We had consort checklists, which started in 96 and 2001, to standardize trial reporting. We had statistical advances, more advanced measures like Bayesian methods, cluster RCT, adaptive trials, et cetera. So we seem to be making some progress in a positive way. But then there were a lot of disappointments in the sense that despite this initial hope that EBM might empower providers, it ends up disempowering them in some ways. And some of this is that EBM trying to reduce uncertainty, which you've spoken of, which can kind of be counterproductive, and how sometimes guidelines meant to help summarize information now became new tools for experts to perhaps drive other providers on how to provide care.
Yes, I think that is that's a fantastic summary of the pros and some of the cons. And the 90s were spent thinking of ideal systems, and one of the ideal systems that emerged was NICE, which was initially called the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. It's been the acronym has been retwisted in various ways since then, but the clinical excellence was the idea that you could improve and make excellent clinical practice by providing doctors with better knowledge bases and a systematic approach to every medical specialty, so that eventually there will be guidelines for everything. Well, obviously that's going to take an awful lot of time. And at the same time, it promised to involve patients and primary care in new ways in an ideal democracy, somewhat like the American Revolution. This was going to bring the pursuit of happiness to everybody, and that everyone was going to be equal. And there were no slaves, actually, in the UK at this time. It ended up creating a sort of sub-slavery, though, because once the guideline was out, you had a standard treatment for everyone who fell within its definition. And this works very nicely where there is good evidence and where it's kept up to date and where there is wiggle room for clinical judgment, but no wiggle room for outright ignorance. And this was going to take a while to settle, and it did take a while to settle. And it became increasingly clear to the NICE leadership that they needed to emphasize that if they were not trying to override particular decisions about particular patients, but they were trying to establish a general standard of good practice where that was available. Then again, the problem arose where that evidence was not available. And here come back the experts who feel that they know best. And these are usually single issue clinicians. We pride ourselves on being generalists. They pride themselves on being specialists. And there is, of course, room for both. But oddly enough, the guidelines, the NICE guidelines, tended to be more imposed upon primary care and generalism than they did on particular specialisms. But they had a good sorting out effect, particularly in orthopedics. I think, orthopedic surgeons tended to go for the latest technology and imaging results. NICE had a dampening effect on that. And all of a sudden you get orthopedic surgeons, particularly in the UK, being keen on evidence-based orthopedics and shared decision-making, and dropping procedures that they formerly thought were great and were earning them large sums of money in private practice, like washing out knees and trimming shoulder joints and stuff like that, which still goes on. But I think it would have gone on to a much larger extent had it not been for EBM. In general practice, it led to a certain demoralization as we became a bit guideline overloaded, and our money started to depend on keeping records of patients with their diagnostic labels and then treating them in certain ways, at least a certain percentage of them in certain ways, and gaming came into it. So the easy to treat diabetics could be forced into having really low sugars, whereas the more difficult to treat diabetics could be exempted. And perverse incentives and a general disenchantment came in together with an economic crash, which meant that the good days were over by about 2008. I'm talking from a UK GP.
I feel like sometimes when I speak with older physicians, it's always lamenting on the good old days. But for me, this is kind of, this is when I was training and I first came about, so I didn't know any better. Yeah.
Good.
So thanks, Richard. That's very helpful. I feel this as well. I share this view that I find guidelines very helpful. So I don't want us to come across as anti-guideline, because they are great resources and they do help summarize the vast amount of literature that I could never read myself. And they provide very helpful evidence-based recommendations on what consensus practices should be and reference of when they should be there. But you rightly point out that there are challenges because there's many areas of uncertainty. Certainly taking trials and turning them into recommendations are not always easy, transparent. Generalizing that to patients requires a lot of nuance. And then when these are taken and turned into quality metrics or pay for performance metrics, it can ironically do the opposite of what they're intended to do, which is rather than helping providers feel autonomous and strengthening their relationship with patients, it can try to reduce us to automatons and practicing within square boxes when that doesn't really exist. And that's a struggle I think every place has to deal with. And it's an understandable one, because on the one hand, having consensus standard is good. Now, you've written about how there's like good variability and bad, and you want to get rid of the bad variability where people are out there doing things which really have no evidence and don't help, as in your example with the orthopedics. But then you want to allow space for good variability just based on normal clinical practice and differences within patients. And it's something I think the EBM movement has struggled with, and really not a lot of great solutions, although I think this is another good transition about what some of these reasons for these problems were. And maybe then we can just jump into and discussing kind of 2020 and some of the EBM revolution and resuscitation, if you will. So kind of we've gone from the 1990s, then we have 2000 to 2010, and then 2010 to 2020, where these issues you discussed and kind of the growth we have from the 2000s kind of just persist without much change. And this is kind of the era where I think EBM has stalled a little bit. And EBM has been around for 20 years at this point, and it didn't seem like there were any big improvements happening. And my opinion on this is I think there was a bit of a disconnect, because the goal of EBM is, of course, to bring clinicians, patients, and readers into closer alignment. But it seemed that we were kind of more going separate paths. And I think there was a disconnect somewhat between the research world and the practicing clinicians world, because EBM is supposed to be about helping physicians at the point of care, having the data they need. But if our research is not generating the data that clinicians need, the advice patients need, or is not doing it for outcomes that patients and physicians are interested in, then it seems like our research is not really helping us and helping to advance where we need it. And we still have large areas of uncertainty and large areas of care where we're not kind of going along. And it seems like the incentives for academics, industry were good, and they're helping us make maybe cutting edge changes in certain subspecialties. But in other areas, it felt sometimes nihilistic. And then, of course, one of the oddities of this is that you think in general in economics, the more you do something, you scale, costs go down. But the oddity of research is that doing trials has just gotten more and more expensive over the years. You have more larger trials you need, more regulation, more oversight, increasing costs, more paperwork that needs to be done. Recruiting is getting more difficult. And then one of the biggest problems in the US is that our research funding is based on this basic science model where you have silos of independent individuals or groups competing against each other for the same resources. But that's bad, because trials work best when you collaborate and people work together collaboratively. But our funding model kind of disincentivizes large network collaborations. So it's kind of a mix and a mess. And the structural factors are not really there to help EBM grow. And then you kind of have 2020 and the pandemic comes, and suddenly it seems like everyone kind of wakes up from this malaise the stalled perspective and suddenly realizes the need to kind of fix this and get evidence right to treat all these patients who are at risk from this coming pandemic. And that leads us to 2020.
It does. Yes, and not everyone woke up. Two people woke up and they talked to each other on a London bus and decided what to do. And the result was the recovery trial, which I'll come on to in a moment. But yes, the list of problems that you mentioned was certainly accurate. And I think that there was a certain disenchantment with the fact that we were having to work all the time from the evidence that was being generated, largely from academe and pharma. And both of them have their own vested interests and selections of topics. And one of the complaints that grew louder from 2010 onwards was that we need medicine-based evidence rather than evidence-based medicine. In other words, the problems of daily clinical life should dominate the research agenda and inform its priorities. And there were moves which were partially successful to move along those lines. In the UK, they were led as so often by Sir Ian Chalmers, who helped set up the James Lind Alliance of patients to damp down the voices of specialists and raise the voices of clinicians who are actually looking after patients face to face. And the patients themselves, above all, were going to have the last say in prioritizing research questions to be publicly funded. Public funding is always a tiny proportion compared with pharma funding. So the two have to go hand in hand. And they have in the UK, which following that financial crash I mentioned, has had a fairly small public budget for health research. In the US, it was slightly different. It wasn't till 2012 that the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute really got big funding, and I was trying to feed into it the ideas of the James Lind Alliance, and to some extent I succeeded. That was a slight change of direction. Patient-centeredness is, after all, as you said, the proper aim of evidence-based medicine and all of medicine. And so these were steps forward, but in the meantime, there was also a sort of nerdification of EBM.
I think PCORI is a good example of the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, because I love the ideals and philosophy of PCORI. And I think the people who work there, who've contributed to it like yourself, have the right aims, and there have been some successes there, but it hasn't really helped transform everything at large. You know, 95% of the research world and how these things are done has kind of stayed the same. And so I think that we identify where these problems are at, but then what are the actual solutions? And PCORI was one attempt. But I think for us in the US, and I think 2020 the pandemic, the really successful model was Operation Warp Speed, and how we successfully were able to push and rapidly do these large clinical trials and vaccine efficacy and just really discover these excellent vaccines so quickly that could help avert some of the worst harms of the COVID virus. And that model for federally centralized, you know, budgets, quick trials, and rapid turnaround, I think is a much better model. But we'll come back to that. And I think you were making some excellent points, and you were going to discuss the recovery trial, I think. And I think those are the two key ones. It's recovery and Operation Warp Speed that really kind of show us the future, I think, of how EBM can do a better job of meeting its needs and kind of pushing research in a more positive way.
Absolutely. I think that those are, you know, if you want to positive examples, The warp speed was the application of new technology at scale and at speed, and gave rise to permanent improvements in vaccine development. No doubt at all about that.
It was a very big, and for us is also unusual because the U.S. government, we have a few federally funded trials, but we've never done something where the government or publicly directly funds and does these kinds of trials. The usual model is the government would sponsor the basic research, and then the pharmaceutical companies are the ones doing the clinical trials. And here you have the government centralizing it, pushing the agenda, saying, get these trials done, giving the money to make it happen, doing it very rapidly. Because I don't think we have the same centralization of research that you guys have in the UK. You know, something like the recovery trial could never happen in the US. We don't have a single federal IRB to get ethical approval across country. Every individual institution has to do it on its own. We don't have a centralized way of doing trial recruitment in multiple hospitals. We don't have a centralized way of gathering, collecting data and doing it. And so you rely on individual silos, and they just can't do these things rapidly. So for us to do something at scale, national level, rapidly, on a clinical trial level, that we've just never done anything like that. And it was like a proof of concept that, hey, we can do this, take notice if we really try. We just have to rethink how our current approach to research trial enrollment, to the way we engage with research has to be rethought.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic, I'll come on to the points you make about the UK system, which is by no means ideal, but in the US, when the polio vaccine competition arose in the mid-1950s, you remember Sabin versus Salk?
This was a bit before my time, but please do tell us.
It would have been. It wasn't actually before my time. I was immensely happy. My parents were immensely happy when I got these vaccines. But they were developed in the US competitively between these two big egos. And they were supported by a Nancy Roosevelt fund where, you know, people went around with cans collecting cents to support this, the development and trials of these vaccines. So things have moved on. Albeit in 60 years, but whereas that is onwards into the future, recovery was to some extent back to the future, because the inspiration for the recovery trials came from this chap between Martin Landry, who ran the program, and our chief scientific officer, government scientific officer at that time, who happened to be on the same bus having attended the same meeting. And they agreed that only by getting in then, which was the 9th of March 2020, when the pandemic had scarcely begun in England, only by getting in then would we be able to recruit all the patients who were most seriously ill to be randomized to the treatments we thought might work. By we, I mean them at that time. And that was the same time when the French man, whose name fortunately escapes me, was trialing hydroxychloroquine. And he got so much publicity for this completely unbased treatment that had to be included in the recovery suite. But the main thing was to initially was to determine whether corticosteroids given at a particular time would improve mortality amongst all the patients who were crowding out all hospitals and creating a fantastic demand for ventilators and ICU.
It was an extraordinary moment, because I remember, you know, I was in Florida and I was doing extra shifts in the hospital in July and August to help with all these COVID patients we had coming in. And even before then, watching what happened in New York, and this sense of paralysis that here we are, modern medicine, getting overwhelmed with this pandemic and not knowing what to do to treat. And we're kind of grasping at anything that came out that might help. So trying whatever people suggested, hydroxychloroquine or you know, ivermectin or whatever things, and no basis for any of it. You know, it felt like practicing medicine before EBM or before evidence, really. And then to just suddenly have some hope, seeing that, oh, wow, these rapid trials are beginning to be done, and then seeing them rapidly enroll and get recruitment up. And then within a, I mean, to get the trial off the ground, and they did it in what, like a week or something, which is absurd to me. If you tell someone in the US you're going to start a national trial and get it off the ground in a week and start recruitment, and they'll probably tell you that's impossible. It's like trying to go to the moon or Mars twice over. But they did
You'd have got the same response in the UK, and 9 days from a conception to inception. Just impossible. And, you know, will be a celebrated item in medical history for as long as it's written, I think. But it was based on the experience of the ISIS trials, and in particular the foreword or the opening paragraphs of ISIS one, I think, report, where it laid out these ideas that, you know, if you were going to examine the effect of interventions for serious conditions that could be measured through mortality, you needed to get as many patients as possible, as quickly as possible, and randomize them, get your ethical consent out of the way quickly because it was a life-threatening situation, and make the consent forms very simple and the report forms extremely simple. And all these things were put into practice immediately. The idea that the NHS is ideally set up to do this is largely a myth, because it actually has 26 different electronic medical record keeping systems. And so it required a data collector of genius who lives two doors away from me to help Martin do this. And she was one of the drivers of the success of the trial. But so was the willingness of the entire medical workforce throughout NHS hospitals in England to actually do this, because they could see that it was needed. And so as soon as one treatment was proved effective or ineffective, onto the next. So it was a platform model, and another amazing achievement was to get the first results out within 3 months and acted on the same day that they were published open access. I mean, you know, this is how medicine should work, where there are simple binary questions that are very important, and you could apply this to a lot of conditions, stroke trials, all sorts of things.
It's remarkable. You've hit on it. I think the key point of this, and the reason they're able to do it so fast and so effectively, is they're copying that model where you want it to be large, you want it to be randomized, but you keep it simple. You know, one page consent, one page reporting, so these people are not getting overwhelmed, and everyone feels empowered to participate. Of course, recruitment, that was not a problem to deal with because we had so many patients in the hospital at that point. And then, you know, of course, in publication can take a long time, but fortunately, they were able to use preprints, which I know have pro and con arguments, but you just put it up there, you know, while you're waiting for journals to do the reviews and stuff. So the day you get your recovery, you can put a preprint up, and everyone in the world knows this now. And then that transitions to really what I think is a huge success of EBM, because here you are having all these people, including myself, trying all kinds of random things, not knowing what to do for COVID, you know, millions of physicians around the world. And, you know, I think 80-90% of us within 24, 48 hours, we're now prescribing, you know, dexamethasone in the hospital. And to me, that speaks like a tremendous success of medicine, that of EBM, that we all been trained, we all understand the nature of evidence and how to interpret these things, and recognizing, oh, this needs to be the standard, this is what we need to adopt, and having no hesitancy to do that.
Yeah. And I think that's a lovely positive note on which to end this podcast. We have, however, left out all the complex stuff to do with other forms of randomized trials, N-of-1 trials, observational evidence, Bayesian.
Yeah, there's a lot more still to discuss, so we will have a few more podcasts to go.
I think we might. So
I will. So I I think it might be good for us to maybe give up some wrap-up points, and maybe we can end this one for today. Does that sound good to you, Richard?
It sounds good to me, and my wrap-up points would be that medicine was quite content with itself, as I described in a previous podcast before EBM. It learned the value of discontent, but then the discontent spilt over a little bit into disillusionment with the whole idea of scientific medicine as a project, because it was being so distorted by all sorts of external forces, and there was a mismatch between the research agenda and patient need and clinician need. And COVID has given us a beautiful example of where those problems can be overcome. In a future podcast, I'll probably tell you about the ways in which long COVID proves that all those problems still exist.
That's right. It is a good example.
It's another story entirely. Yeah. So that would be my summary. What would yours be, Raj?
So I think mine would be that, and I never really appreciated this before because I wasn't there, but a lot of, I think, the EBM in the 90s, the rise of it was somewhat technologically driven. I mean, creation of the internet helped spur a lot of these things. But I think, unlike the start of EBM, I don't think the future evolutions of EBM are going to be relying on just some magical new technology. I think we're going to have to put in the hard work. It's going to require some bits of reform and changes and how we think about regulation, funding, infrastructure of trials, and really trying to do a better job of aligning the needs of patients, clinicians with researchers, and just get better and faster at generating evidence and figuring out a way to scale this so that we can make this cheaper and easier. And to me, the answer of that is, as you pointed out, is really focusing more on large, simple, randomized trials, getting the costs down and getting them done more easily and more quickly.
Yes, and the use of routine data, et cetera, et cetera. But we shall talk about that before long. So thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye. Thank you, Richard. Bye-bye.